Good afternoon, I'm Dan, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
And thank you guys for showing up here this afternoon. I was asked to do, I was actually first asked to do the Traditions in Relationship workshop. And I told them, that's not me. And so they said, well, what about steps 1, 2, and 3? And I said, okay, that fits me better. When I was in my first year of sobriety, I wandered into a big book enthusiast meeting, right? Where right from the gate, I was exposed to the steps outlined in the big book, and that wasn't necessarily my first. It wasn't until like 9 months of sobriety. I actually had 4 sponsors before that. Gave me various different approaches to the 12 steps. Some hospital program pamphlets, some the 12 and 12 and some other stuff. And looking back, I think it was all good because it gave me something to compare what I did with what I was shown afterwards. And, there's a lot of different approaches, and if I sound rigid, I'm sharing what I'm passionate about, and I certainly wouldn't stand here and say that anybody's staying happy and sober wrong, right? And I know that AA's created this enormous net, right? And there's, if you don't like what I'm doing, you might like what somebody else is doing. If you don't like what other people are doing, there's somebody, hopefully, that you'll find that fits better for you. I tend to attract the people that are very obsessive, right? Because I was exposed to a lot of different things in the beginning. The first thing I was told to do was to write an autobiography of what I thought the first step was about, right? And all it did was give me an opportunity to write a whole bunch of stuff that I already knew about, and it didn't necessarily give me any new information, nor did it tell me really what step one was about, because I didn't really know. I was just told to write what I think it was about. The next pass through step one was some pamphlets. I answered the questions that I thought applied to me. The rest I figured didn't apply to me. And still, I didn't quite understand the whole thing. And the other thing was the 12 and 12. And the 12 and 12 is a great book. I think there's so much good information, but when you read the first step in the 12 and 12, there's only 4 pages, right? And I think it's 2 or 3 places it says it references you've already talked to your sponsor about this, right? So again, I didn't get a lot of information from the 12 and 12. And Alcoholics Anonymous made it 15 years without the 12 and 12. So, but it's laid out in such a way that it's just so much easier to read. It says, here's step 1, here's step 2, here's step 3, right? And in some ways, I wonder if they did that with the big book, if people that weren't actually thinking they want to be in Alcoholics Anonymous would want to read a book laid out like that. This is step 1, this is step 2. They'd say, okay, well, I'll read step 1 and see what it says, and then if I decide to go on, so I think that, maybe it was obvious back then to the people that were around in the beginning where step 1 is in the big book, but it's not quite as obvious today, right? Because it doesn't say in big bold letters, here's step 1. In fact, it doesn't say anything until after the ABCs, where it says being convinced of these 3 pertinent ideas, we're at step 3. And from then on, it tells you where every step is. But even then, it's not at the top of the page. It's like buried inside of the book, right? And even the reference to step 12 is not in Working with Others. It's the first sentence before step 12, where it says, the next chapter, which this is on 88, the very last sentence on 88 before Working with Others says, the next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12, right? So the book really is laid out in a way that separates the steps, but until I was shown how to find step one, I really didn't know where to find it when I was new. So coming, being confronted by a group of people that were very rigid and say, this is the way we're going to do it, I was attracted to that. Because I had just went through a handful of sponsors that really didn't know what to do. In fact, I was sure that I could help them figure out what I needed. But that was me. And when I got the sponsor that I ended up with for most of the beginning of my sobriety, which was Joe H., I approached that relationship the same way, thinking we're going to have to sit and talk about what I need. You know, that wasn't quite the case. He knew what we were going to do. And it wasn't really up to me. And Joe was the kind of person that's like, either you do what we're going to, either you do it this way, or maybe I'm not the right person for you. Right? And I really understand that because, you know, he had put a lot of work into it himself as far as understanding the steps and, you know, in the process of the 12 steps. In fact, he actually, in his first 5 years, went through the steps with probably some of the more impressive people to me throughout the country. And our Saturday night speaker actually is one of them. Bob O is one of the people that Joe went through the steps with in his first 5 years. But his exposure was first with Don P. from Colorado. I don't know if you've heard that name. And a guy that it was called Big Frank, who was a very large sheep herder attorney, and very mean, but very strong, and also an American Indian named Don Coyas, and Bob O, and a guy named Paul Stanley, and Gary Brown, who was Don P's sponsor at one time. So anyway, those were some of my first influences Joe's first influences. And I came around when Joe had about 5 years, and I kind of got the best of from all those people. And that was my first exposure. So what I'm going to talk about isn't necessarily all original. Certainly it's going to come through my perspective, right? And I've had ideas that have evolved of my own naturally. But the basis of this is simple. Go through the big book, turn the statements that the big book says into a question that personalizes it to myself. Bill did this back then. Did I do that, or how did I do that? Right? And when it says pray, we pray. When it says write, we write. Just take the book for what it says. And you know, there's a lot of different people that do big book workshops and study the big book, and it's all great, right? But I think that it's important to know that, you know, that it's real so easy to keep it out there as those guys back there did this. You know, the history is very interesting to hear, right? But it's those guys back there did that, right? And I think that just making this little tiny adjustment to it, saying, how did I do that, or did I do it, right? That just makes the world a difference, because we'll find that the way the steps are laid out, it is actually, when you consider your own experience with what it's saying, you go on this constant journey that burrows inward, right? Because we first look at the alcoholism around us, and then how it affects my mind in here, and then the unmanageability in here, and then it just starts going deeper and deeper, the second step and the third step and the inventory, right? And it's this amazing constant journey inward, right? And so with that, what I usually do when I start with this stuff is I tell people to turn to the first page of the big book, right? And usually they go to the title page, but I'm talking about the first page, this one, right, the blank one, because I think that that's a good place to talk about having an open mind. I find sometimes new people that have had trouble staying sober are the easiest people to work with. Right? Sometimes new people that have had absolutely no experience can be real easy to work with. Till they get around people that say, well, you don't have to put all that energy into all this, right? The hardest people to work with are the ones that have been around for a long time. I don't need to do anymore, right? Coming to this thing with an open mind is certainly important. And it's not because I think you should listen to what I do and change what you do, right? You know, but maybe sometimes it's just about how hearing that little thing that's going to make me that much more effective with the people that I sponsor. Right? Maybe there's a little twist that does sound interesting. Right? So coming to this thing with an open mind and is certainly a good thing, but also an open mind about what's wrong with me. Right? What's wrong with me? Because in the back of an alcoholic's mind, there's that little voice that says, well, maybe I'm really not as bad as you people. Maybe I don't really need all of this, and maybe I don't really... Maybe I made too big a deal out of all this. Or what about somebody with time? Like, you know, they haven't drank for 20 years. In the back of their mind saying, well, maybe the problem's not there anymore. Right? One of the things that has been popular in my sphere of influence, I guess you'd call it, is going through the steps more than once, right? Just to reinforce that part of me that wants to start fantasizing the idea that maybe the problem has been removed, right? Completely, and I'm not alcoholic anymore. Truth is, I don't know. All I can do is base it on what I know, what my experience is, not from what I think might happen. Right? And there's a lot of people with time that fall into that place, that don't stay sober. I mean, time isn't necessarily certainly time is important, don't get me wrong, and it certainly makes it easier, but it's no guarantee of sobriety, right? Nor is time a guarantee of quality of sobriety, right? Because some people can have a lot of time and be so dry they're a fire hazard. Right? but we were only supposed to stick here to steps 1, 2, and 3, and I'm going to try to take a little break in between it. I was told I could have a couple hours, and CDs only record around an hour and 15 minutes, so we're going to have a little tiny break in between here to be sensitive to the CDs and the smokers, okay? So, coming to this thing with an open mind, and it scares people when you say this, like maybe starting with the questions, maybe I'm not an alcoholic, right? And that's not to send people screaming out the room, it's for an alcoholic to ask that question and to be honest about that they have that little voice in the back of their mind that doubts that they really need to be here. Right? Maybe I'm not. And we just go through the book and say, okay, what does the book describe an alcoholic as? Right? Because that is going to be what tells me what my experience shows me. You know, maybe I'm an alcoholic. Maybe what comes out of it is I'm a drug addict. Right? On the first page, the title page, where it says Alcoholics Anonymous at the top, there used to be a circle and triangle on there. And that was a good place to talk about certain things. One of them is the fellowship, the unity recovery and service, but it was also a symbol for mind, body, and spirit. Right? Now, it's also a good place to look at the idea that I suffer from a problem that's a threefold disease. Now, that might be contrary to what some big book speakers talk about. Some of you have probably heard people talk about a twofold disease. Have you heard that? Yeah? Heard it? Joe and Charlie actually do, and some others. But just to reference it, so you, in the bottom of page 64, where it says, from it, on the last paragraph where it says, resentment is the number one offender, it destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Mm-hmm. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. It says, for we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. And when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Right? So that's one place that references it, there being three things to look at. Now, as we get into the first step, a little bit more, well, I'll break those three parts down because it's important to know certain parts about that. You know, because I'll touch on that in a minute. Okay, let me just lay some stuff out for you on the contents page if you have your book with you. In the front of the book is, I consider, general information. But what I start to, but I break the first step down into three parts. The physical problem, what happens when I start to drink out here, right? The mental problem, what happens in here, in my head, the obsessions to drink with no alcohol in my system. And then the second half of step one is the unmanageability. Right? Now, in the first edition, Doctor's Opinion was actually page one. So it was kind of, some people weren't very happy when they moved it into the Roman numerals, because what happens with a book that you pick up that you're reading for the first time, you skip to page one just to get into it to see what you're looking at. Right? And that has caused a bigger problem than what some people would imagine, and I'll get into that in a second. But if you want to take some notes here, from the doctor's opinion, it was the beginning of step one. And I look at the physical problem, the physical part of my alcoholism, from doctor's opinion to the top of page 23. Then from page 23 to 43, I look at the idea of my mind, what happens before I take the drink. Then I look at the unmanageability on 44, 45, and 52. And 52 is an interesting page. Just to jump ahead briefly, it talks about the bedevilments, which outlines a picture, gives me a picture of my life. And we look at it from different perspectives, right? In the first step, I look at it from the idea that I can't manage my own life. Right? I'm powerless over these things, right? In step two, we'll look at it a little different. In step three, I'll look at it the same page a little differently. And if we were doing an 11th step, if this was including the 11th step, you can go back to that page and look at it from a perspective in the 11th step. Right? It becomes a great meditation. So I look at We Agnostics as step two. And from then on, it'll tell you which step you're on. Right? So that's the plan of action here. And if you don't have a big book and you don't want to write notes, I actually am going to put together something to put on my website, thejwalker.com, eventually, that'll have some basic, just basic instructions that you'll be able to download. So one thing I'd like to touch on real quick is that I've got a new book. I started a brand new book with absolutely no notes in it. So before I had everything marked, so an XIII, the foreword to the first edition, tells me something real important. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Right? Now, remember I talked about this being a threefold disease? That's an important note to take. Right? Because it says I recover mentally and physically. Right? It doesn't talk about that third part that we're going to talk about. And it says that to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And that tells me that this book is where the instructions are for where they want me to read to see precisely how to recover. And I'm going to start this with making a point on page XV with the forward to the second edition. At the very last paragraph on the page. And I'm not going to read a lot in this. I'm going to skim over a lot of it, but this is real important. Where it says, the spark that was to flare into the first AA group was struck at Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. Does anybody know what kind of physician Dr. Bob was?
Proctologist.
But you know what was interesting about that? He was a proctologist before it was an actual specialty. Right, so he specialized in areas that other people at the time didn't want to. So that's all that means. No, it means obviously that he was probably a pretty smart guy because he was digging around in areas that might, okay, that was the wrong choice of words. No, but okay, the other thing is it talks about Bill being a stockbroker, but that wasn't a licensed position at the time. There wasn't an actual stockbroker certificate, right? So these are guys that excelled in what they did, and people trusted them to do it, right? And I don't know if you can imagine if someone says, hey, there's this doctor in Akron that's doing some great work with alcoholics, and you just happen to be in the area and you thought you noticed you're right in front of his office and you walk up to the door because you think, well, maybe I'll talk to this doctor about my alcoholism. And you read the door and, let's say, Dr. Bob Smith, proctologist, you'd have to really want to get sober, wouldn't you? Anyway, 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of the drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following the meeting, a meeting with an alcoholic friend, that was Ebby Thatcher that comes to Bill in his story, who had been in contact with the Oxford group of that day and also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism who is accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members and whose story in the early days of our society appears in the next pages. That's the doctor's opinion. So here Bill refers to the doctor's opinion on what alcoholism is about makes him no less than a medical saint. Right? I would say the doctor's opinion was pretty important, right? And rolling it back into the Roman numerals caused people to skip right over it in the beginning, right? Unless you're a great reader, which I wasn't, and liked reading the introductions or the prefaces. It says, from this doctor, the broker learned of the grave nature of alcoholism, right? So I'd say the doctor's opinion is really... I'm stressing that point, aren't I? Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, he was convinced of the next five. There's five tenets that he was convinced of, but there was one that he wasn't convinced of. And if you look at 290, it's either 292 or 293, depending what edition you have. 292 in the third edition, 263 in the fourth edition. Those are the six tenets of the Oxford group. Right? He was convinced of 5 through 6. What Bill wasn't convinced of was complete deflation of ego until he understood what the doctor's description of alcoholism was. Right? So Bill had experience with the Oxford group. Bill had experience with churches, with religion, right? But something happened when he heard the doctor's opinion that made him think it was worth putting page one in the big book. So it goes on to say, tell a story about him being out of town in Akron for work, feeling that he wants to drink. And what he suddenly realizes is that in order to not drink, that he needed to find another alcoholic to talk to. See, he had had some exposure with Abby, and Abby brought him the some Oxford Group stuff, and he had been going to Oxford Group meetings, and that's what the Oxford Group did. They basically went out and tried to help others. That was the basis of their program. Right? And he was out of town, and he realized that he had to find another alcoholic in order to save himself from not drinking. So he had this list that he put together of people to call, and he went down this list, and there was he wasn't having much luck calling priests and any of the other people on the list. And there was one name on the list that he really didn't want to call. It was Henrietta Seeberling. That would be kind of like going to Palm Springs and trying to look up Betty Ford. Right? Tell her, I don't want to drink. You know, she'd just say, "I'll call the hospital." You know. No, she would not be the first person that you would think of if you were an alcoholic and you were in Palm Springs, right? Henrietta Seeberling was like that. She was high society, and she was, you know. But he ended up calling her. And what she said was when Bill told her what he wanted, that he was looking for that he was an alcoholic and he's looking for an alcoholic to talk to, what she said was, "Thank God we've been waiting for you." Right? See, Henrietta Seeberling was in the Oxford Group, and they didn't tell you what your problem was. You're in the Oxford Group; you were supposed to confess what your problem was, right? And then turn to God for help with it. So they weren't telling Dr. Bob that he was an alcoholic. Because they wanted him to just confess that himself. But what they were doing is, because they knew Dr. Bob was an alcoholic and not willing to confess to the community that he had that problem, and rightly so. I mean, if I knew a doctor, if I had a problem down there and I knew a doctor was an alcoholic, I'd certainly have second thoughts about using him. But they had been holding little prayer groups amongst themselves, asking God to send help to Dr. Bob. And then they get this call from Bill out of nowhere. So her response, "Thank God we've been waiting for you." Mm-hmm. And Henrietta Seeberling sets up this appointment for Bill to go talk to Bob, and goes on to say, "This physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but it failed. He went to church. He was a member of the Oxford Group. He had the solution all around him." Right? And that's sometimes the way some AA meetings are, is people in the middle of a solution all around them and not getting it. But when the broker, Bill, gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue his spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. Right? So what that tells me is that there's something important to know, right, about what's wrong with me. And it's to the extent that I realize what's wrong with me, right, is going to be how hard I turn to step two, needing power. Right? Because if I don't understand at a deep level what's wrong with me and know that I can't do anything about that on my own, then I'm not going to need much power when I go into step two. If I don't see the insanity in step one, then what am I asking for? What am I asking for in step two? Needing a power to restore me to sanity, right? Because the insanity they're talking about in step two is not my problems at work and my problems at home. It's my problems with alcohol that they're talking about. And they're going to talk about that in step one. So with that, I'm going to turn to the doctor's opinion. So let's see what the doctor has to say about us. An XXVI... What the doctor says is that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. So Harry's making a separation between a problem with my body and a problem with my mind. Right? Remember I said that this first part of step one, we're going to focus on the physical aspect of the problem. What happens when I take the first drink? What happens after? It says, it does not satisfy us to be told we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life in full flight from reality or outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. Right? Certainly we had mental problems, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. And in our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factor feels incomplete. If I had the obsession to drink every day and I only had one beer, that wouldn't be much of a problem, would it? Right? Or a glass of wine with dinner. Right? That might make me nervous, but it wouldn't impact my life like the way my life had been impacted. So it's telling me here that I need to look at, what happens after I put alcohol into my system. The doctor explains it like an allergy, and I've heard it explained a few different ways. It's like if I'm allergic to strawberries, I could break out in a rash. It doesn't matter whether I want the rash or don't want the rash. If I eat strawberries, I'll break out in a rash, right? And it's a physical reaction. Right? And I look back at my experience and look at how I drank. Not how I drank in the beginning, not how I drank necessarily when I wanted to drink. Right? But what about when I didn't want to drink? How did I drink? Right? The times that I should have not drank as much as I drank, right? When I was with people I shouldn't have been drunk around. Right? When I had things to do afterwards that I shouldn't have showed up drunk. Right? How did I drink at those times? Some people have to look in the last few weeks or few months of their drinking to look at that part of it. Right? That in some ways is the downfall of intervention. It's not letting someone get to the point where they didn't want to drink it anymore. Right? Where you have to be shown that it was bad. So sometimes interventions can be too soon, right? Right? It wasn't for me. I went 2 years trying to control my drinking and failed. Right? So the doctor talks about it being like an allergy. So let's talk about what an allergy was in the 1930s. It wasn't like what it is today. You couldn't go into the grocery store and see 20 feet of allergy remedies. You couldn't make an appointment to go see an allergy doctor because they didn't have them then. If you were allergic to bee stings and you got stung by a bee, they'd rush you to the hospital, poke a hole in your throat so you could breathe until the swelling went down, right? If you had kids that had allergies, there was no allergy remedies for them. You had to pick up and move. Try to find a place where they wouldn't be sensitive to what's around them. So it was a problem that affected people, some people, in a manner that other people didn't get affected. Right? And in a lot of cases, it was life-threatening, right, and incurable. So from that perspective, my alcoholism is certainly life-threatening. It affected me in a way that it didn't affect other people around me. And it was absolutely incurable. I couldn't stop drinking on my own. Nor could anybody else stop me. So also from that perspective, alcoholism is like an allergy for me. So there's a lot of different reasons why some people would say they drink. I like the definition the Big Book gives me on XXVIII, that's Roman numeral 28. Which says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. It's pretty simple. I like the effect produced by it. I wouldn't say that I love the taste, right? Some people want to say that it's a disease of feelings, but that would have meant that when I felt good, I would have drank less, and that wasn't the case for me, right? My grandmother, everybody always brought her booze at Christmas time for presents, right? And it was always the really sweet stuff, like Bailey's. And she would like to call me over and say, come on, let's get drunk. So she'd pour a couple little glasses of Bailey's. And she'd take a couple sips, right? And then after a few sips, she'd get this little giggle on her face, and she says, I got to stop now. I'm starting to feel it. Right. That's not necessarily something I relate to, except from the perspective of there's people that are very different than me, right? The kind of people that stop when they're starting to feel it, right? You know, just kind of illustrate that, because you know that's when it starts for me, when I'm starting to feel it. Another useful tool is Bill's story. I use that as a tool to relate my alcoholic life to Bill's life. I go through and I underline everything that I can relate to, setting aside the differences, how he thought, how he felt, how he drank. And those are interesting instructions too, considering I don't like going back and forth because that has a tendency to be confusing, but for this particular thing, I want to point this out, where it says, the bottom of page XII, it's Roman numeral 7, I'm sorry, 12. In the middle of the paragraph, it says, if you have a drinking problem, we hope that you may pause in reading one of the 42 personal stories and think, yes, that happened to me, or more important, yes, I felt like that, and most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. Just so happens one of those, the first story that they give us is in the front of the book. And those are some good instructions. You know, can I relate to an alcoholic's life? Right. And Bill's story is laid out interesting. In fact, if you when I read it, I make little notes in the on how I relate to Bill's story in the margins. You know, and he starts off by where it started for him. He was in Europe. Where he felt like he was a part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I underlined that. I wasn't in Europe. I was in Culver City in a gas station when I felt like I was a part of life at last. Right? In other words, you might not have been a stockbroker, but you might not have been in Europe as a soldier. You might not have, you know what I'm saying is just set aside the differences and go through, and you'll see that the way Bill's story is laid out is he starts off with, this is where I started to drink when it really started to work for me. It might not have been his first drink, but that's where he felt he was a part of life at last. And it goes through this progression. And I go through it, underlining it, and looking at my own drinking experience and seeing, okay, this is where I started. This is what happened through my drinking career and how much alcohol became a part of my life. Right? And then he starts to talk about how that way of life started to impact his life, right? And I start to relate my life with that and say, okay, here alcohol started to affect my work and started to affect my relationships, right? Although I didn't think I was an alcoholic, right? You know, I used other excuses for the businesses failing and the relationships falling apart and the problems in those things. I used other excuses, and it wasn't until I was encouraged to look back and connect my drinking with the way I was living, where I started to see that you know, alcohol played a bigger part in the way that my life was steered than I had ever thought while I was drinking and in the middle of it. Right, and then Bill gets to this point finally halfway through where he starts to make some attempts to stop, and fails over and over and over again. He also gets to the point where he talks about jumping out a window, right? And I actually related to that too, because I remember sitting there in my place thinking that, you know, that actually sounded like a good idea, just jumping out my window. And that obviously was something I underlined. It might not be something you underline as far as being a window, But you might have had your own thoughts of ways to get out of the way you were living, living in that alcoholic torture. Right? So I use Bill's, the first half of Bill's story as a tool to relate my alcoholic life to Bill's. Right? So because of time, I can't go through every little piece of it, but there's a question that has to get answered. And there were some questions that have to get answers, that have to get answered. And one place to look at them is page 20, the bottom. It talks about the three types of drinkers. It says the moderate drinker has little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. And I ask myself this, could I give up liquor entirely if I have good reason for it? It says they can take it or leave it alone. Could I? Right? I couldn't. Then we have the certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. I did. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. Could have. Sometimes an alcoholic death isn't necessarily physically a medical problem related to alcohol. You know, if someone dies of a car accident, right? While they were drunk, the cause of death might have been car accident, but that could have been another form of dying of alcoholism. But if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or warning of the doctor becomes operative, this man can stop or moderate. Although he may find it difficult or troublesome, he may even need medical attention. So I ask myself, I break that down. I said, if I was sick, would that have stopped my drinking? Right? It wouldn't have. Falling in love, right? Would I stop for her? I didn't. That was my experience. I didn't. In fact, I threw my wife out before I was willing to change the way I was living. I was blaming her for my drinking. Change of environment, right? I know from the past that I had moved away from friends thinking that they were the problem, right? Because they were too crazy. And if I go over here, not hang around those people, then that would taper it off some or level it off some, and you know, never really putting all the blame on myself, right? Because really, the problem wasn't outside of me; the problem was inside of me. The warning of a doctor, right? I don't even think I was honest enough to any doctors that I would get a warning. So, because it never got to the point where I was confronted by a doctor with alcoholism. But with this hard drinker, it says that this person could stop or moderate, even if they needed some medical attention or some help. Now, I actually went to a psychiatrist, $70 an hour to pay for. I paid $70 an hour to talk about the way I was drinking, never once got referred to Alcoholics Anonymous, and never really was completely honest with him. So I couldn't stop on my own, and I couldn't stop if I became faced with any of these things in my life. But then it goes on to talk about a third drinker. But what about the real alcoholic? It says he may start off as a moderate drinker. I did. It says he may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. Sometimes the word continuous throws people. Because what's continuous to someone who's an alcoholic? Right? And what's continuous to someone who's a non-alcoholic? Right? So you have various perceptions of what continuous means. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Right? And I start to see that this book is putting words to things that I couldn't otherwise explain. Right? I used to think that I always decided into the next drink. Right? I think I'll have another. I think I'll have another. But looking back at trashing a business and trashing the relationships and trashing all the dreams, the things that I thought that I was supposed to have in life, right? And looking at how alcohol affected those things, and then to say I was choosing to drink that much, right? And I see that once I started to drink, I didn't have any control of how much I drank. So there's a question at the end of this physical section on the bottom of page 22. And this has to be answered in this first section as far as the physical, my physical experience with drinking. It says, we know while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We're equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, that makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. So the question here is, does my experience abundantly confirm that once I take any alcohol, whatever, into my system, something happens? Right? Both in the bodily and mental sense that make it virtually impossible for me to stop. Right? And I see that if I, even with all of the excuses I had with to validate why I drank too much, nothing was sufficient in the light of the fact that I got to the point where I didn't want to drink that much and kept drinking too much. So you'd say, okay, I see that I drank too much, right? So there's another question that follows, and that would be at the top of page 23, because here's where the book switches to the mental part of the problem. It's obviously, if I didn't have this other problem, I would say, okay, I'm drinking too much, I got to stop, or if I don't stop drinking like this, she's going to leave me. Or if I don't stop drinking like this, I'm going to mess up work or school or what, right? But I keep drinking like that. This next section says, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink. Meaning, it'd be good to know that I lose control once I start, but if I could just not take the first drink, I'd be fine. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. And through this section, from the top of 23 to page 43, I keep the focus of the idea of what does my mind do with alcohol before I take the first drink, right? And they start to talk about obsessions of my mind. An obsession is something that outweighs all other thought, right? Which should be differentiated from thinking about drinking, because just thinking about drinking wasn't my problem. It was the thinking about drinking that, it was the thinking about not drinking and drinking anyway that was my problem. Does that make sense? Right? The obsession, when I'm telling myself that I got to stop doing this and I'm still heading for the liquor store, right? And there were so many experiences just walking down the street, talking to myself out loud, saying, why am I doing this? Right? Liquor store, luckily, was only a block away from my house and I didn't have to drive there. And I remember screaming at myself on the way to the liquor store, thinking, what's wrong with you? And you must be crazy. And it's like, keep something in mind. This was back in the 80s, right? Today, when someone's walking down the street talking to themselves and yelling at someone, it means they're on the cell phone. In the 1980s, it meant something different. Right? So, I remember standing at the corner, waiting to cross the road, thinking if I just jump out in front of one of these cars, that was the only way that I was going to be able to stop drinking like this. You know, the question of choice comes in a lot. Especially you hear it a lot of people in meetings say, today I choose not to drink. Right? Here's what the book talks about when it comes to choice on page 24. And notice that it happens to be in italics. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reason yet obscured, has lost the power of choice in drink, where so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We're unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Too many people make too big a deal about the word choice, because I really don't think it was ever about choice. I think what it's really about is sanity. Because from an insane place, I can't choose not to drink. Right? From a sane place, I can't choose to drink. So either way, it's not about choice. So, in the mental part, it's going to talk a lot about the idea that we have this strange insanity when it comes to alcohol, right? And to see the insanity at the depth for what I have to see it, I have to see not how I drank when I wanted to drink the way I wanted to drink, but focusing on how I drank when I didn't want to drink, right? I mentioned this yesterday. You hear people in meetings say insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. As long as I expected different results from my drinking, I had hope. Right? It got to the point where I continued to drink, knowing I didn't want to drink, knowing that I was unable to stop drinking, right? Completely baffled, and no one had to tell me. I figured I was crazy, right? And that was true, right? There was an insanity that was going on that I could absolutely do nothing about, right? And so it was in that insanity that I experienced what the book calls alcoholic torture, right? Having a mind that absolutely wanted to die and not live that way, but a body that couldn't change. I just continued to live that way. I decided to stop drinking 2 years before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and started making decisions on how I was going to do things differently. Right? And one by one, those ideas of ways that I was going to control my life and my drinking just got smashed. And smashed and smashed until I got to the point where I knew there was absolutely nothing I could do about me not drinking. Right? And I thought that I was the only one in the world that was experiencing what I was experiencing, that nobody understood. It was insanity. And I think that this Jaywalker story is one of the best, is a really good example of that. But you've all read the Jaywalker story in the Big Book, right? Well, I'm going to change the words for you, and I'm going to tell you why I'm going to change the words for you, because at the end of it, it says, "You may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit that if you substitute alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly." All right, so on 37, here's the story, but I'm going to substitute alcoholism for jaywalking. Our behavior is absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. He gets a thrill out of hanging out at the bars. He enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. Up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. I think that was me. The way I was drinking was a foolish idea of how to have fun, right? Luck then deserts him, and he's slightly... And he goes on major benders several times in succession. You would expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. Presently, he gets drunk again, and this time has a medical complication. Within a week after leaving the hospital, he's back at the bars again on another bender. He tells you that he's He's decided to stop drinking for good, but in a few weeks, he's back at the bar. On through the years, this conduct continues, accompanied by the continued promise to be careful or to keep out of the bars altogether. Finally, he can no longer work. His wife gets a divorce, and he's held up to ridicule. He tries every known means to get the drinking idea out of his head. He shuts himself up in a rehab, hoping to mend his ways. But the day he comes out, he races back to the bar, which puts him back in the hospital. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? Okay. And I could relate to the insanity of that, trying over and over again to stop and failing. Okay. So, check my time here. I see that I have a mind that sets that takes me back to the first drink. And that's no matter how I feel, no matter what I want, right? I drank that way. I drank too much when she left. I drank too much when she came back, right? I drank when the team won. I drank when the team lost, right? There was something else going on in my mind, one of the questions that's rarely asked is, a lot of people could tell you, oh, the obsessions take me to the first drink. I think it's important to know what sets up a condition conducive for the obsessions to return. What sets up the condition conducive for the obsessions to be there, right? In the second half of step one, we look at the unmanageability. Right? I cannot manage my spirit. And when I was new, I was told that this is a spiritual program and I have this spiritual problem and what the heck is all that? Right, you know, after the way I trashed my life, I didn't really like your reference to God, right? Because I was sure that there was no God that would work for me, right? But certainly, alcohol made me willing to listen to what you had to say, and certainly, there was people around me that gave me a little hope because they looked happy. So I was willing to go along with what you had to say, right? So on 44, it says, if a mere code of morals or if a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. So I thought that if I had better morals, or if I had a better philosophy of life, that I would get what I needed out of life and everything would be okay. And I always, my philosophy of life is that if I get the right education, I'll get the right job, and that'll bring me enough money, and then I'll buy the nice house and the right car, and all my stuff would attract the right her, right? And thinking that if I just set the stuff up around me just right, then I wouldn't have to feel the way I felt or drank the way I drank. Always blaming for the things around me for the condition of my life, right? And certainly for just the way I was drinking, right? Because I thought that the time would come when everything would fall in place and I just wouldn't want to drink this much, right? Except I would change cars and change girlfriends and change businesses and never quite getting the right combination around me. Unable to find the philosophy of life that comforts me. And about wishing to be moral, if you asked me, I was probably one of the more moral persons you could meet. Right? But what I failed to see is that I knew what was right or wrong, but I did what was right for me. Right? Sometimes at the expense of others. So the fact is that I didn't have the ability or the power to live up to my own sense of morals. And I didn't have the ability or the power to arrange my life around me to get that philosophy of life that would comfort me. I lacked power. Right? Lack of power, that was my dilemma. Right? So Turning to page 52, I look at let me just ask, till what time do I have, can I go with, without running out of room here on the tape? Pardon me?
19 minutes.
19 minutes? Okay, great, great. I started a few minutes late. Back up to page 45. I was going to skip over something because of time, but I don't want to skip over this. Where it says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, but it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how are we to find this power? And that's what the rest of the book is about. But the interesting thing about a dilemma, if you look up the definition of a dilemma, it doesn't mean a problem. It means faced with alternatives that we don't like or want. I got that out of the dictionary, and I thought when I read that definition, I thought, alternatives. I saw that on the, that word on the page before, and it gives me two alternatives on the page before. In the middle of the page, it says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Right? That's my dilemma. Go on the way I'm going without power, drinking, or to have an open mind over a spiritual way of life. Right? I didn't want to stop drinking, but I couldn't continue. Right? And I didn't believe that there was a God that cared about me, and I had no clue how to get that or if that would even work. There was a part of me that really believed there was no such thing as a God that would work in my life. So I can't go on this direction, and I have no clue about this direction. Don't necessarily want or like either option. That's a dilemma. So I look at page 52, where it says, in the middle of the page, where it says we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. Right? We did that over the first part of step one. In the past, I'd always looked at my alcoholism, how it affected the people around me or the things around me. Right? But here, we looked inside for the problem rather than outside. So I've changed my point of view about the obsession and the craving, looking inside for the problem. So here, it says, why don't I do the same thing with my human problems? Look inside at those problems rather than outside. We were having trouble with personal relationships. I turned that into a question. Am I having problems with personal relationships? Inside, I'm saying. Not putting the blame on her, right? Just looking at my personal relationships, love relationships, family relationships, work relationships, those other AAs. Am I having problems with personal relationships? Couldn't control our emotional natures. Now, controlling my emotional nature isn't me not saying what's bothering me. Not controlling my emotional nature is the stuff that's going on in your head that's eating away at your lunch. Right? We were prey to misery and depression. Do I find myself in those days where I'm sitting there with the drapes closed and I'm not answering the phone and I don't want any contact with anybody and I'm just really feeling sorry about my life? Can I do anything about that on my own? Just we couldn't make a living. Right? I kind of like looking at that as I couldn't make a life satisfying enough to keep me happy or sober. Since we had a feeling of uselessness. Do I? Do I feel useless in the world? I certainly did when I was new. We were full of fear. Right? Hasn't fear always robbed me of the life that I might have had if I didn't have it? If I didn't let it control me and every direction I turned? It says we were unhappy. Well, if everything else there is true, that probably is a no-brainer. Right? And it says we couldn't be of real help to other people. I mean, and I separate real help from help. You know, there's a difference between driving someone to the message and actually carrying a message. right? Driving someone to a meeting and actually working the steps with them. Right? Can I be of real help to other people? It's not a basic solution for these bedevilments more important to me. Right? So I look over this page and I consider those things and if I can relate to those things being a problem in my life today. Right? I use this page as a palette to paint a picture of my spiritual condition. I know some of you heard it last night, but I like the reference to like how an artist would paint a lake in the middle of a valley with hills and trees around it. Right? The way they paint that which is transparent, the lake, an artist will paint that by painting the trees and the mountains in the lake, the reflection of it in the lake. And my spiritual condition reflects around me. Right? If I'm in a poor spiritual condition, if I have problems with this stuff that it talks about here on page 52, the reflection in my life is all of these problems around me. That paints me a picture of my spiritual condition. Right? It puts color to what's going on inside, which I normally can't see. And I have to look at that and see that I can't do anything about that on my own. I've tried. And what this tells me is what the program tells me and what the book talks about is that I have a spiritual malady that sets up a condition conducive for those obsessions to return. Because when I have problems with this stuff, when I'm new and well into sobriety, with decades of sobriety, I can have problems with this stuff. Because the book, remember I talked about it in the beginning where it talks about we recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body? It doesn't say we recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind, body, and spirit. Right? See, what the book tells me later on is all I have for this part of the problem is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. It says we're never... On that page, it also says we're never cured of alcoholism. And I look at alcoholism from three aspects. My physical alcoholism is I lose control when I start. My mental alcoholism is I suffer from obsessions that take me to that first drink, an alcoholic insanity. Right? And there's a spiritual side of my alcoholism, right? And I'm never cured of that part of it. But the problem does get suppressed. And all I have is a daily reprieve with that. So, what I have to see, though, is that when I, well into sobriety, if I can look at this page and I still relate to this stuff, I'm closer to that condition where the obsession can return. Because it's painting me a picture of my current spiritual condition. Right. Does that mean you're going to drink? Maybe not. Maybe it means you're just going to shop a lot more. Right? Or eat more, or whatever. Right? But if those things don't do it for you, and things continue to get worse, an alcoholic will go back to what they really worship is their solution. That which they perceive will get them out of that condition. And it's interesting because I've worked with non-alcoholics and we've not knowing what to look at for the first part of the problem. We start here. And I ask, okay, well, if relationships got bad enough, where would that take you? If it got really, really bad. Right? See, with me, I know that if things got bad enough in my life, I'd probably drink again. Right? But I've worked with people that weren't alcoholics and that were actually in AA. And I remember one woman I sat with, and I said, "Well, if the relationship got bad enough, would that take you to a drink?" And she said, "No." And I said, "Well, where would it take you?" And she said, "I'd eat." And we went through each one of those things, and that was her response. And I said, that's kind of unusual because I I would have thought that it would have taken you to a drink. And she said, no, I'd probably eat when all that stuff gets bad. And we were talking, and it turns out that it was a food program she started in. But they told her to go to AA, that's where the better recovery is. Right? And for all those years, she was thinking she was an alcoholic. Right? Having problems going through the steps because she started a spiritual process with a lie. Right? And I'm not saying that to police AA. I'm not telling you if you don't relate to this, you should get out of here now. All I'm saying is you need to be aware of your own truth and why you need. By the time you get to this point, you have to know why you need to move to step two, needing power. Right? Because I have to know what do I need God to save me from? Right? What do I need an act of God to save me from? Right, because I get to this point and look back at step one, and the experience for me is not that I can't drink again, but that I will if something more doesn't happen. Right? I need something more than knowing what's wrong with me. Because if I see that I can't do anything about this on my own, right, and I see that I could drink again, and there's nothing separating me from that next drink, then I have to. And I go into this hallway, right? I've walked through this door of step one and closed it behind me, and I see the truth of my alcoholism and what's wrong with me, and that I could drink again, right? And there's this other door into step two, right? Can I see the insanity of my alcoholism? Can I learn to go along with the idea that I need this a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity? Right? And if I don't see the insanity in step one, then what insanity am I going to talk about in step two? Right? And we'll touch on that when we get back in. But right now, we're going to stop here and take about a 10-minute break. Okay, thanks.